I'd like to call the meeting of May 15th to order. I'll ask staff, Mr. Wong, do we have a quorum?
Yes, I do. Commissioners Fields, Winship, and Nush asked to be excused, and Commissioner Thompson will be a few minutes late.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, with that, let's move on to the approval of minutes from the public hearing of May 1st. Has everybody had an opportunity to look at those and review those?
Sure.
Any comments, corrections, discussion?
No.
There being none, I'd entertain a motion to approve the minutes of May 1st.
So motion.
Second.
Okay, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No abstentions. Okay. Let's move on to our first discussion item today. We have the South Downtown Subarea Plan, a draft environmental impact statement. Review public comments on the draft plan and EIS documents received during the comment period from March 26th through May 3rd. And information has been distributed by Sherry Gibbons. So with that, who is Sherry? Are you the?
It's me, yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
Good. Thanks, Don. Sherry Gibbons, Planning and Development Services. Just going to briefly go over the process to date and the comments that we've received, which you have received a copy of, and you also have a copy of the transcript from the public hearing, which was on April 25th. So this is a project that is funded through a grant from the Department of Urban Housing and Development in the Puget Sound Regional Council, and began in 2011. We've had extensive public outreach to date. We're doing this in partnership with the University of Washington Tacoma because we're also going to approve their master plan through the SEPA, and they're co-lead. Just a state requirement, so we need to plan for the future. That's what we do. And so these are the 2040 citywide targets, and so the South Downtown is the southern half. We're also getting ready, which I'll mention later, to launch the North Downtown Planning, which will be the partner to this, and then the MLK, which Brian's been working on. Here's the boundaries of the South Downtown subarea. Some of the goals are to maintain eligibility for the state and regional transportation funding, to accelerate public investment in downtown, and to gain a competitive advantage. Oops. Go back one. So as I mentioned, the project began in 2011, and there's been monthly steering committees, which are members of the community and local business owners. And then we have also the council formed a working group, which meets quarterly. And they've been reviewing the plan as it's come along, and comments were released on a as they were drafted basis. And we got feedback from them and have been incorporating comments to date. So it was really helpful. And then the plan was released, the draft plan and EIS, on March 26th. For a little bit longer than normal comment period, about 5 weeks, and we had a public hearing at UWT, which we had a great turnout. About 6 people came and commented, all positive, really good things to say, and so you can read what they had to say if you'd like in the transcripts. Not a lot of substantive comments, though, but it was still pretty positive. And then the comment period closed on May 3rd. So you guys haven't really had a chance to review them, but it was pretty much positive feedback. We're in the process of incorporating all those comments into the final EIS. In the next 30 days, we'll be circulating a matrix with the comments and responses as we move forward, and then hopefully come back to you guys for the Planning Commission public hearing in September of this year.
Did any of the comments that were made have any impact and make any changes to what you'd already written?
Well, because we had released it as we were drafting it, there weren't a lot of surprises. So there are a few changes that we're going to make, but not a lot of substantive changes.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
And I have a question as well. It's great. It seems to be getting really good feedback, positive response. But are there any issues if you had to throw one or two things out that will take more work, or we're going to be paying special attention to as we keep moving through? What would those
so,
topics be?
probably relating to transportation, because we're doing an area-wide SEPA review, we're taking away project-specific SEPA review.
Correct.
And so some of the agencies have expressed concerns about their authority or their chance to review some of these projects. We'll be adding some mitigation into the plan, which will set certain thresholds for when they will be involved.
DOT, mainly.
DOT is one of them, and then the tribe as well.
Okay.
Yeah. Any other questions?
The level of service, I think it was E or F. It was E.
It's F, I believe.
F?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think that you really need to articulate what that means, because I think a lot of people don't fully understand what it does mean. If you have public transportation or transportation alternatives, you know, that, and typically, the way I'm familiar with that, if you have a bus that seats 30 people, that's worth basically 30 trips, car trips, et cetera. And the way we used to do that, that would affect, you'd have lines drawn. If you cross those, you would get credit for public transportation. But I think that's a fairly complex issue, and it really is going to rely on, I think, public transportation. So I think that really needs to be articulated in the document. And I think there was some discussion. I went through those comments this afternoon. There was some discussion about possible impact fees. I don't know if the city now collects impact fees. I don't think it does. So, you know, there's some major implications there.
Thank you.
Anybody else?
Thank you.
Okay. It's a lot of work. I mean, we have another one coming for North.
The North Downtown. We have our community meeting on, I forget the day. It's the end of next month, though. We'll be doing the community meeting.
Okay. It's 29th on your agenda.
29th.
29th. So it's good. It's a lot of work.
And I would just add, from the transit perspective, I'm actually being quiet right now. Pierce Transit had made some lengthy comments, so I checked in with staff, and I'll be recusing myself as you move through this process. I just don't want to have a conflict there.
They were good comments.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. It was a long letter.
It
felt bad.
I think it's probably the most complete letter there.
Thanks.
Thank you. Sherry was very helpful with the that project that was presented that we did with the Amtrak station Citizens Advisory Committee for the relocation of the Amtrak station. She was the backup.
Yeah, I'm sorry
right.
to have missed that meeting.
Okay, we'll move on to our next item of discussion, mixed-use centers zoning code update. It looks like Mr. Baudet.
So we'll see. I highly doubt that I'm going to get done in 5 minutes. So pretty impressive. So I provided a memo, and this is really as sort of an initial kickoff presentation with the commission. We did had a similar discussion with the Environment Public Works Committee in sort of middle of last month. So wanted to talk to the commission also about one of these projects that's coming forward, and this is in part as also we are going to be moving forward here in the next month or so to talk about the work program in a general sense. As the commission is aware, there has been a lot of discussion about the work program, how it gets put together, and the idea of doing that more so in consultation with the city council now. So obviously the first step there is to put our heads together and figure out from the Planning Commission's perspective and staff's perspective what's sort of the first cut at what things we are looking at over the next year or probably two in reality, since one of the big items is the 2015 comprehensive update that's coming forward, which we have talked about a couple times and likely is a multi-phased project even moving forward to that. But like I say, from a work program perspective, this is another item that we're going to be looking at here over the next probably 6 months or so, is a project that really came out of Councilmember Beau and his interest to sort of look at and rethink from a little bit of a market perspective, I guess, the mixed-use centers. And, you know, the reality, of course, is that the mixed-use centers are, let me see what my second slide is, The mixed-use centers are certainly very much a key focus of the community's entire growth strategy. You know, this idea that we are going to focus long-term growth, both employment and population, into these concentrated areas within the community in a more transit-oriented, more pedestrian-oriented manner. It's partly a way to protect single-family neighborhoods, but at the same time to allow for growth in a way that can be more sustainable long-term. So the issue we've certainly run into, and I think I allude to it in the memo, is, you know, the mixed-use centers have certainly been around for a long time. It's not a brand-new concept in the city of Tacoma, or certainly even regionally. We've had them since the mid-90s, and unfortunately we have still seen a fairly limited amount of growth in those areas. So there is really an interest and desire in trying to figure out what are some of the barriers that might be there in our code or potentially in other codes that are really preventing the kinds of growth from happening that we talk about and that we envision in these areas. So the focus for this project is really intended to be specifically on the neighborhood mixed-use centers. I mean, as the commission is aware, we have actually four different types of centers. But in many ways, the neighborhood centers are the ones that are sort of always at the forefront, I think, in people's mind of what ultimately capture the idea of the urban village, the area where you would live and where you would work potentially. You know, it's the small-scale areas that are ultimately, in large part, sort of the heart of neighborhoods. It's the historic business districts in many of our neighborhoods. So these are in the maps up there, but Proctor and 6th Avenue and McKinley and, you know, those sort of relatively small-scale, neighborhood-oriented service areas where the intent is that you could live within or within a few blocks or whatever and be able to walk to these business areas and get a majority of your services met and certainly be able to maybe work there or at least hop on a bus or a streetcar or something and go to your job if it's in another center or downtown or otherwise. So that, like I say, from a geographic perspective, that's really the intent for this project, is to do that sort of focused code analysis and market analysis directly on the neighborhood mixed-use centers themselves. So project, how we have sort of identified it and discussed with council, is the idea of really two phases. First, to sort of look at, and we have done much of this already over the last couple of months, is from an internal city staff perspective to sort of run some scenarios through our process and sort of try to self-identify what sort of issues that we bump into. You know, the vision is certainly along a core pedestrian street. You've got retail or restaurant or whatever it is on the first floor with 2, 3, 4, 5 stories of residential above. We have seen very little of that kind of development. What are the barriers that potentially that folks run into, and how many of those do we control? And then the second phase is really taking some of that initial information and going out, working with the architecture community, the development community, the funding folks, to sort of identify from their perspective what issues do they see and what barriers do they see, again, in getting this kind of development. So as far as how we wanted to go about that, and this in part comes, again, from Councilmember Bowe, the thought has been really to run some prototype scenarios. This is actually a drawing that he put together, intended to be sort of a generic dream project, I guess I'll call it that, you know. So potentially some structured parking. You've got the retail, you know, pedestrian-oriented spaces on the first floor, and then you've got 3, 4 or so stories of residential above that. And then internally, when we went through our first phase, what we did was identify a few different locations within the city where these kinds of projects might be desirable or called for in the code. So we chose 3 mixed-use centers. And those were not based on any sort of assumption that those are the most likely or the most desirable or anything like that. We really were just trying to get a variety of circumstances, recognizing that the zoning changes between some of the different kinds of centers and the physical realities changes between some of the different kinds of centers. And the biggest one that we notice and we run into is a lot of the stormwater type issues, and that there are clearly different parts of the city based on where they drain that the stormwater requirements can be vastly different and in some cases have significant impacts on being able to build these kind of small infill you know, basically property line to property line kinds of buildings. So just quickly, a couple of some of the things, and I will say this with the recognition that, and this is partly why this is a two-phase project in the first place, is that I think we understand that it's at some level is always difficult to step outside of your own code, which you are in charge of enforcing and administering on a day-to-day basis, and at some level justifying probably to the private development community. And trying to examine, well, what's wrong with that, or what could we do differently? That's not always an easy thing to do. So we certainly have gone through this with that sort of an effort, but recognizing, and that's why I say there's the two phases, is, you know, that's a starting point, but it, we also need to go out and talk to the outside folks who have a different and important perspective on what works and what doesn't for them. So these were some of the issues that, that we came up with, both on land use and building code side. One of the struggles we have is still parking, which is an interesting one because, you know, as the commission's aware, we have gone through over the last few years rather significant reductions in the parking requirements. And in fact, these projects built on a core pedestrian street would have no parking requirement. So it's not a code requirement actually creating a parking problem, but more a functional reality of trying to, of the market still wanting to provide parking and in many cases provide a decent amount of parking, actually, for these kinds of projects.
Does the parking have to actually be provided in the building? I work in cities where, in fact, you get a credit if it's within so many hundred feet, and you've created an incentive then for a private developer to provide the parking, maybe a parking garage over retail.
Sure.
And that comes in and makes it financially feasible for the person to do it.
So is that like them selling the parking credits almost to other people? Is that kind of the idea there?
It's another source to go to fulfill your parking requirement.
Yeah. Right. Johnny's got extra parking, so I'll go use some of his.
You do it on a case-by-case
approach. Sure.
But
so
basically, it doesn't have to be provided in the building if it's within a close walking distance.
Yeah. So since we have no requirement, we actually don't care, honestly, if you have no parking at all. So if it's a long ways away, you can still count it. So if you can justify it to the bank, I guess, that's going to loan the money to build your project, you know,
so when
go
you say
for
parking
it
in building limitations,
yeah,
that's not required, but that's optional parking. Is
that it's totally optional parking. And we also do, I will say, just as a side note, because we do have parking requirements in some parts of the mixed-use center still. I mean, we're sort of focusing on right on the core street, but there are allowances for shared parking and off-site parking, 500-foot distances. Okay. Basically what we have in the code, so you can use parking within a 500-foot distance of whatever your site is. If you do have a parking requirement, you can use off-site parking. So now the issue we run into, and this is that from a structural perspective, usually they want to, you know, it's difficult to do ramping on small sites. So a lot of the discussion we always have is in our neighborhood mixed-use centers, they tend to be chopped up into relatively small pieces. You know, you have 25 or 30 or 50-foot wide lots. You know, structured parking takes up a lot of space to go up or down, whichever direction you're trying to go. And on these small sites, like the example that was put forward by Councilmember Bowe, it's basically so small that you can't do ramped parking. So because the other thing is most of the mixed-use centers that we have are flat. And what we see in downtown is that the slopes allow people to get some flexibility on providing parking. You get multiple levels inherent in your site, and so you can come at and get access to parking garages from multiple levels. Now we're pretty slick. Well, you don't actually get basically any of that in almost any of the mixed-use centers. There are a few slopes around, but if you think of Proctor and 6th Avenue and McKinley and all those areas, I mean, and there's a reason why they're flat. You know, it was a streetcar line running up to a sort of a flat plateau in most cases, so there doesn't tend to be a big hill there. So that's one of the things we really ran into was from a market, and this is one of, I think, one of the big discussions that we'll have to have moving forward when we get out to the private side is what are some strategies to deal with that market demand for parking. So even if we have gotten ourselves as far out of the way as we think we can by saying there is no requirement, there is still probably an issue there of trying to meet market demand, at least in the first stages of mixed-use center development. I think that's one of the other things we've certainly heard is, and this is true in South Downtown as well as MLK, some of that recognition that where you are now is different than where you want to get to, and you need to be careful about how hard you push at stage one, you know, recognizing that at some level there has to be a cultural shift and a market shift to ultimately get you to where the vision is trying to go. Building height limits, we have different height limits in the mixed-use centers. Essentially, some of them are 65 foot and some of them are 85 foot. So the prototype that was put together was about an 80-foot tall building. So obviously it only works in some and not in others. The reality is you'd have to lose a floor or two in some of those. So, and we have, you know, I think, again, as the commission's aware, there's constant discussions about what the right and or magic height limit is that somehow gets you the types of mixed-use development that we talk about. I don't think there's any desire to reopen that in any grand scheme of things, but you never know. We spent years talking about it. We may never stop talking about it.
Is that wood frame construction you're looking at?
Five
stories?
Yeah, so this 5/2 concept that's always thrown around. So the city of Tacoma, and there's a few other cities, Seattle does it as well, but I think Tacoma was one of the initiators of this concept of a 5/2 construction, which is five floors of wood frame construction over the top of one or two or three levels of basically concrete construction. And the idea is it's one of the cheapest ways to get relatively dense. Because as soon as you go beyond that, you're essentially building a high-rise. And, I mean, we've always heard that there's sort of a dead spot in height limits where you sort of get up to this 85, 75, 85, 95 sort of range that is 5/2 and allowed. And as soon as you go past that, the construction costs associated with building high-rise type construction push you to probably needing to get up to 130, 140, 150 before it starts to pencil out again back to the same sort of rates of return. So so there's, like I say, there's always discussions going on about this 5/2 being sort of a magic sweet spot. Honestly, the 85-foot height limit in MLK is very much a reflection of trying to get to around that 5/2 concept. That same 85-foot height limit exists in Stadium and a number of other areas. So, you know, it's close to that area. We have in downtown, you'll notice we have 90-foot height limits and 100-foot height limits. I mean, they no coincidence that they all happen to be floating right around that same level. So, yard space is an interesting one that came up, and I guess I'll note there's a few that that council, I think, in their initial discussion expressed some willingness or some initial desire to really think about or reconsider how critical they are. One of the big discussion we had with them, and I think the one that we'll have moving forward, and I guess for Planning Commission here, one of the things that would be most helpful at this stage for us is to hear what are sort of core values, I think is the statement that council sort of made. This idea of, okay, we want to be flexible up to a certain point. You know, we want stuff to happen, but we obviously want good stuff to happen, or at least not stuff that detracts from the long-term vision of where you're trying to get to. So in the reality, we have, you know, 10, 15 standards or whatever it is. Which of those are, when it comes down to it, the real core ones that if we get those wrong, you know, we blow the whole concept? Whereas which ones are on the list that, you know, good things? You know, there's no standard we have in the code that's not a good idea, not a good thing, but which ones are ultimately less critical? So the yard space is one, actually, that when we had this discussion with council, they sort of identified as is potentially less critical, I guess I will say. So back when we went through the townhouse discussion, which was largely focused around the West Mall area, there was a lot of concern about the idea of the limited amount of yard space that was being provided over in that relatively dense residential area. So there was a yard space requirement created for townhouses, but also for basically any multifamily development. So your 5/2 building that you want to put up in MLK would have a yard space requirement. Now there's an allowance for balconies to count for part of that and other things like that. So it's not necessarily, you know, the traditional concept of the backyard behind somebody's house. There is, you know, the recognition that there are urban spaces that can help meet yard space. But the truth is that you still end up having to provide some sort of courtyard patio thing. So I think the balconies basically get you up to about 50%, and then you still need some other space to count for the rest of it. Well, it's another one of these circumstances where we recognize that on big projects, they tend to be they tend to inherently create courtyards because large residential projects are usually shaped like a U, shaped like an E, shaped like, you know, there are certain modules of residential development that just make sense. You have a central hallway with units on both sides, effectively, and that creates a certain size of project. And so on big sites, you see this on Thea's Landing and numerous other projects where the style of the building, just getting the light and air into the units, forces you to have open spaces anyways. But on a small project, well, lo and behold, you don't necessarily have that same reality. So in the prototype that was put together, there is no open space really left. And what it forces you to do, in theory, is do a rooftop common deck space, which can be problematic because as soon as you do a shared rooftop deck space, you have to have multiple access, including an elevator probably, and all sorts of things that get really expensive. So the discussion, I think, from council was in part the idea that, hey, you're in a mixed-use center. We have parks in many cases. And, in fact, that's the basic intent for how we're going to achieve and provide recreational space in general for residents in those areas. So that is one method by which we achieve these needs. And then, and I think this is certainly true in the MLK discussion and the whole discussion that the commission had about complete streets, was in many ways the streets themselves are intended to provide part of the recreational benefit long term. Now that comes from the city improving the streets in a certain way that makes them a more amenable recreational amenity, you know, which gets back to the bikeways and bike boulevards and improved sidewalks and street trees and all these other kinds of things that make essentially walking or bicycling along the road a pretty good option. But that is another one of those mechanisms by which that recreational space is intended to be achieved long term. So, like I say, that's one of the things that the council pointed out is where some flexibility might make a lot of sense. The upper story setbacks is, this gets back to the wedding cake. This is another one that I think some council members have had concern with all along. And there's two components. One is an upper story setback along the front, along the street frontage. So once you get up to a certain height, you're supposed to step back your building. And this is based on the idea of both shading and sort of a pedestrian scale or pedestrian orientation to the structure of the buildings. You know, it's a neighborhood scale development, so nobody wants Times Square, and the idea is the taller you go at some point, the step backs try to help reduce the apparent mass of the buildings.
The taller is 85 feet.
Taller is 85 feet maximum, yes. So the other one is the residential transition, which is the real wedding cake. Sometimes on the backside of buildings, there is, many folks will probably remember that diagram that shows you stepping back, you know, it's like 10-foot step backs all the way down if you have a residential property adjacent behind you or across an alley or across a street and stuff like that. So it's another one. And we have heard with some development projects, there was a development project that was proposed for 6th and Alder, which is where the old Happy Dragon was, and it's now turning into a sushi place. Anyways, there was a project there. It was in many ways the right project, structured parking, retail on the first floor, 4 or 5 stories of residential on top, all of that. You know, the market at some level was probably ultimately the thing that killed the project, mm-hmm. but one of the concerns that they expressed all along was the idea that they have residential across the alley to the south of them, and that step back requirement took a lot of space out and made for a very structurally and functionally awkward building in many ways. So,
especially on such a small lot.
Yeah, you got yourself 120-foot deep lot or something like that. You start chopping away at it. It gets kind of complicated. So we also ran into that issue on Pool's Corner, which is 6th and Union, which is where Forelli's Pizza is. So they ended up asking for a variance to that standard, that same residential transition standard, and did get approval of that, but it was something they ran into as well, as, you know, the amount of step backs required just gets pretty complicated. So the minimum density is another one. This is an interesting one because it's one of the few places where we actually say a project is too small to be allowed. And the last time we went through this process in 2009, we increased the minimum density requirements, in some cases pretty significantly, to 25 dwelling units an acre or 30 or 40, depending on sort of where you're at and what sort of project you're doing. that makes a lot of sense, but at the same time, it also prevents projects. And I think the argument has been made, and rightfully so, that in some cases you're preventing projects that are moving you in the right direction, even if they're not the ultimate dream. So the most dramatic example is we have folks that come in and have a single-family house that want to turn it into a duplex or something like that, you know, divide it up in some way. And the minimum density requirement might be 4 units or 5 units or something like that. It often is on a single-family house-size lot. And we basically tell them, well, no, that's not big enough. You can do a fiveplex, but you can't do a duplex. And everybody kind of goes, really? I mean, 2 is better than 1, isn't it? And the reality is they walk away and they just leave it at 1.
I hope we do talk about that more, because the more people can get living in these districts and, you know, their feet on the ground and staying there,
yeah,
whether it be a smaller development or,
I hate to miss that window.
Traditional families changed so dramatically. It's typically a single mother with a kid or two. So we need to reflect changes in lifestyle.
Yeah.
And more grandparents now cohabitating with the children. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's an issue we've seen all over town. I mean, the reality is household size has reduced dramatically over the last 40 or 50 years. You know, it used to be up 2.8 or 3.0 or somewhere in that, you know, the nuclear family or whatever that everybody was planning around. Well, now it's like a 2.1, you know, and the reality of how many either single or two-person households you have has dramatically changed. And so the recognition of, you know, everybody needs a single-family house because everybody's a family and has two kids is a little ridiculous. There's certainly a market out there for that and a need for that, and probably always will be. That's fine. But there's certainly a lot of people creating an additional need for smaller units in different sort of circumstances, and we certainly want to reflect that as well. So the live-work piece is, you know, there is a continuing discussion going on about live-work, and the City Council also received a presentation recently on some building code changes occurring to try to address and improve live-work allowances. It's something that I think we will be continuing to work on for a few years to figure out exactly how it plays out. Unfortunately, most of the codes don't really address work-live and live-work scenarios very cleanly. The fire code is one of those that it struggles with, where you're starting to mix uses into single units. But the building code also struggles with it a little bit. I mean, I think for the most part, the land use code is not a significant barrier, particularly in the mixed-use centers, where we generally are allowing both types of uses. And honestly, we don't so much care about how big one chunk is versus the other or exactly where they're located. I think the one obvious thing is that we do have requirements in many cases for that ground level street uses to be retail or pedestrian oriented types uses. And one of those questions has been whether or not live work or work live, whichever one it is, do those make sense to also allow along that first floor of those core pedestrian streets? So
work live would.
Work live would currently.
The jeweler who lives in the back of the shop.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, perfectly fine now. Yeah.
On Pool's Corner, that's all office above, right? There's no.
Yeah, it's all off. There's no residential there. Yeah. So mixed use in some ways and not in others, depending on how you define it. Yeah. I mentioned stormwater before. There's a lot of discussion going on about stormwater and how it relates to trying to grow these sort of dense urban areas. Stormwater gets complicated, and from a environmental standpoint, there is the general desire to address stormwater more locally at the site of, you know, the actual development. So you want to try to do more on-site infiltration in as natural a way as possible. Now, the reality of doing that in a dense area is pretty tricky. If you're trying to build property line to property line, there's nowhere left to put in the rain garden and the pond or all of the, you know, infiltration, the other types of infiltration facilities or treatment facility. All these things get really complicated. So there's a big discussion going on in the city about how we can better address, and maybe there are area-wide approaches that we can consider to try to sort of get a halfway between, I guess, where it's not just stick it all in the pipe and it runs out the faucet at the other end, but still not all the way down to the level of every single person and every single development has to try to keep every bit of water on their actual site, because that gets pretty tricky.
This was the deal, you know, when we finished the mixed-use work, God, has it been 4 years ago, 3 years ago, when
Bo had the same concerns as many of us did, that this is the deal breaker to make, to get people to come in and redevelop or develop new, the infrastructure requirements. I mean, you, if you could do some kind of narrow down on a couple mixed-use centers and focus dollars, you know, to meet the developer halfway, to do some improvements, mm-hmm. do a planned action or programmatic EIS, yeah. get some of that stuff plug and play ready.
Yeah.
Can't do it all. We don't have the money to pay for all that, but that's the barrier
yeah.
to development is sort of our conclusion at the end of the day.
Yeah. And I think...
Go ahead. Something that I would mention with this is the new stormwater requirements that are coming out with the growth management, whatever it is, thingy by 2015 when we have to redo yeah. and update that. I think that's going to play a big part of that. So maybe we want to start looking at that now so that we can figure out how that even ties together. Because we yeah. got, I saw a big presentation on that a couple days ago, mm-hmm. yesterday or something, and it actually makes it more cost-effective for the developer, more cost-effective for the city, better overall for everybody, but it's just doing it the right way and having the right things in place. If those things are in place, everybody benefits. And so this might be a good way to start preliminarily trying to do some of those things, or at least putting them out there to see how they float, maybe even before the requirements are out there. I don't know. Just
yeah.
a way to start playing with it is what I'm trying to say.
These water gardens or on-site storage?
Yeah, so they had tons of different... things that would work well. The MBA is one who put that thing on yesterday, so maybe contact them. They could probably give you the slideshow of it.
yeah.
So it was really informative, and it okay. was really,
yeah.
I mean, that might even, if the presentation was probably only 20 minutes.
Yeah.
That might even be something worthwhile having a presentation here by somebody, yeah. you know, so that we can see what that is and what that looks like.
Yeah. Yeah, I will say in there, and this is another one of those situations where there's sort of a, and I probably oversell it, but the idea of a cultural shift or a change in the standard way of doing business mm-hmm. is occurring here, and we are clearly at the early stages of that, and there's still a lot of discussion and disagreement about, you know, whether the old way is easier or cheaper or the new totally, one's going to be yeah. slick. I mean, you know, that's all still at some level to be defined, and many of the technologies are still... you know, being developed as to what is going to be ultimately the best way to really address these sort of stormwater issues, particularly in urban areas. So, yeah, there has been discussion going on at the regional level. There is a new NPDES requirement on the city that goes into place in mid-2015. A lot of that is about really promoting low-impact development techniques as being sort of your primary, the place you start when you start figuring out how you're going to develop your site, that low-impact development is the first way you do it. Or try to do it. And so there is, and I'll talk about this under the work program, actually, but there is a project we are just starting up that's in response to that new stormwater manual to try to look at mechanisms and what can be put in place to better institute and, at least prevent there from being conflicts or ways that various codes prevent you from doing these kind of new techniques and then potentially look at incentives and other things like that. But, yeah, it's all about integration and how it works.
And I think even with that, as we're talking about that, kind of in conjunction is even using the public space, so like the sidewalks, mm-hmm. putting down pervious concrete, because if you put down the right layers of that pervious concrete, that can eat up more than your entire space on that sidewalk, you know, that's right in front of yeah. the building. Okay, if we allow the developer to use that space, yeah. if they're doing it appropriately,
yeah.
the pedestrians aren't going to have a problem with it. It's going to use up all that surface mm-hmm. water. You know, I mean, just I mean, that's yeah. why I'm saying thinking outside of the box of even outside of the site, but not something that's an off-site. Okay, this is six blocks down
yeah.
type of thing.
Yeah, so. Hard to get a sidewalk to suck up all the water coming off the roof of your big building. I will say, and
I will say that the yeah. presentation did go into that and
yeah.
kind of. I mean, they it was a very brief
yeah.
overview,
yeah.
but it was actually
yeah.
very
yeah.
It was very informative, and yeah. it's very easy to do. And it's like yeah. the maintenance on that kind of thing. The Kitsap HBA actually did something with their entire parking lot,
mm-hmm.
And it sucks up everything. And, yeah. you know, there are different jurisdictions require different maintenance schedules on it because mm-hmm. once the pervious sidewalk's been there for a while, it can get clogged up.
Sure.
But, you know, it's just...
Yeah. The tricky part is that the underground power is actually supposed to be under the sidewalk. So I don't know if you can. I don't know if you can have the water draining on top of the power vaults.
You guys have done some cool stuff on Wapato.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's really
yeah.
cool.
Yes.
You got to see it if you have it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff being done on Pacific Avenue. There was a lot of stuff done over by Cheney Stadium, you know, sort of looking at different techniques and how they can be used and things like that. Like I said, I mean, the trickiest one is a lot of hard surfaced areas, you can use pervious pavement, you can use rain gardens, incorporate those in and address the issue in significant sense. But buildings, you can't really have infiltration into. So
a lot of these mixed-use centers, I mean, they're fantastic ideas. The stormwater things are fantastic. The problem is the utilities that he talked about, conflict, and also the conflict with soil types. A lot of those mixed-use centers are in areas that are glacial till. It's like concrete itself. So totally. Getting them to infiltrate in those areas just doesn't work. So
yeah, I'm not saying it doesn't. Yeah. I'm just saying that
no, we've got to look at really all of fantastic that, stuff.
Yeah. In the right location.
Yeah, in the right location is really, mm-hmm. really fantastic. Mm-hmm. So
come on out to Spanaway. And we'll take care of it.
Then you'll be lining up with there you Clay.
Go. So, and I think, you know, the point is well taken. I think there's, in my mind, probably no doubt, and we've seen this in the subway plans as well. I mean, the subway plans are obviously all about trying to get things to happen, and so they are at the same time, in some ways, a similar sort of barrier analysis, not quite as detailed as this, looking at, you know, particular types of prototypes in particular locations. But, you know, and the idea of infrastructure and the difficulties that we have with the age of our infrastructure in general and the needs to upgrade it not only to just accept whatever the impact is of the project, but all the new standards that are coming along about how we want to do that in a better way is a significant barrier, probably one of the biggest costs in the grand scheme of things to what it takes to move into, you know, the city of Tacoma in general. And it's one of the reasons why we struggle in a large sense. You know, it's certainly, you know, the sell has always been that it's easier to develop in an urban area because the infrastructure is already there. It's probably been well oversold because, especially in a place like Tacoma, yeah, the infrastructure might be here, but it's 90 years old, and so you've got to tear it up and replace it, and guess what? You're tearing it up and replacing it in an area where it's very dense and there's lots of people, and it's complicated to tear up the road and shut it down for 3 months and all those kinds of things. So as I mentioned sort of early on, there's this discussion about core values. One of the things we did was try to go back and look in general about sort of design or, you know, urban design goals of the neighborhood mixed-use centers in a general sense. Again, sort of preempt this sort of discussion about core values and what are the most important things. And I highlight pedestrian-oriented there because I think in coming out of the discussion with the council, it was probably easily the most repeated term. Sure. Now, multiple of those tie to pedestrian orientation, in fact. But as far as the idea of what is the ultimate thing that we are trying to achieve, I think their feeling was that was probably right at the top of the list, was making sure that when you are developing in a neighborhood mixed-use center, you're creating projects that are pedestrian-oriented. That's the ultimate sell, is long-term people are going to be able to walk, you know, from wherever they're living to down to the bus stop or to the store or whatever it is. And it ties in with making things dense. It also ties in with making things sort of urban in their context, having the buildings out to the street and having the windows along the street and those sorts of things that we do on the land use side to try to make sure that we achieve that goal of pedestrian orientation.
It's pedestrian safety, too. It's the speed of travel of cars on the streets and slowing traffic down so that it's not threatening to pedestrians.
Yeah. What else do I have here? So standards, like I say, the reality of those goals is that they play out in numerous standards, and I think there's two. There's two slides on this, but, you know, it goes through in relative detail what all the various standards are that play into meeting those goals. And I mentioned a few, you know, like the building, the bonus program, the yard space, the residential transition, you know, a number of those that get back to that idea of, they're really based on, in part based on pedestrian orientation, but largely based on compatibility in some cases with surrounding neighborhoods. And then the yard space, obviously, based on the idea of livability and trying to create spaces that encourage families and others to use them and sort of balance the realities of urban life and hardscapes with some sense of beauty in nature. So these are the building design standards. Again, a lot of these tie back to pedestrian orientation and reality. The surface standards, the windows, the mass reduction, all of those are really tied back to sort of making things at a neighborhood scale or pedestrian scale. So just again, the intent is that the next phase, and or hopefully we'll be starting this up here in the next month or so, we'll be going out and talking to the builders and the architects of the development community, essentially development and funding community, to run through a similar concept of scenarios and potentially to put some numbers, I guess, next to some of the discussion that we have about what the issues are, what the requirements are, and what impact those have on the bottom line of what either gets or doesn't get these sorts of projects to move forward. So that's all I had. Like I said, with you know, any input that I think the commission has, we're just at the early stages of this laying out the intent for the project, but certainly any thoughts that you have on how to move forward, or like I say, what are some of the most critical components in your own mind on the neighborhood mixed use centers in particular, that, you know, these core values of what we want to make sure that we get right and move forward. I think that's an important message that we certainly can use and take forward both to council and to that to the private development community.
Are we going to have a copy of this slide presentation, or do we have it?
Yeah, we'll email you one afterwards.
I mean, there's kind of a question in the back of my mind with, you know, you're saying, we've been in a major recession for the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
And obviously that affects, but also I'm seeing all this Martin Luther King Way sub-area, I'm seeing South Down sub-area, Brewery District, you have all these areas we're trying to push for mixed-use type major development.
Yeah.
I mean, what is it, 30 million square feet I saw somewhere? I mean,
South Downtown number, yeah.
Huge amounts of space over the next 15 or 20 years. And
plan
I think
for
that's
it.
Something that you're probably going to want looked at, okay? You know, maybe we're putting too much out there at one time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the things that, when I worked up in Vancouver, B.C., that really stuck with me is they controlled the zoning. And they did the house thing where you took a big old house and you put it in triplex or fourplex, just dividing up, maintaining that, mm-hmm. that house. But they took areas and they limited, so that the focus was on a limited area, and they would redevelop a 16 square block area probably within 7 or 8 years completely. New stores and everything, and then
yeah.
they would move on to the other, rather than chasing with utilities development all over the place. And what I'm seeing here is, you know, it's a wonderful vision to have all this intense development, but it doesn't seem to be very focused. I mean, it looks like you've got so many competing centers going on at the same time.
That was definitely a concern when we're going through the mixed-use districts. It was like, 17? Really? Come on, I know everyone wants one, but in reality, it's not going to work that way.
Right.
And now that you have the other areas, I agree, that's a real concern. And that's, even with a hot economic engine going,
right.
it would be tough to
right.
even see any of those pop. So there's only so much you can do unless the economy is that demand.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky because, I mean, the reality of most of the mixed-use centers is they are in areas that were zoned for mixed use anyways. These were commercially zoned areas in large part that allowed for residential. We have titled them all and called them all mixed-use centers, and yeah, there is the feeling that, well, when we go down that road and we call them all centers, they are inherently priority areas for redevelopment. And that's true. Now, whether or not, you know, we all recognize that we can't focus the actual resources into 17 different areas, I think I would say there is no doubt that, you know, the focus area that you talk about is basically the Foss Waterway for the last 20 years. That has been the most obvious and most intensive focus area for the entire city. You know, we've created a development authority. We bought all the property. We put in all the utilities. We cleaned up the sites. We did, you know, all of it. You know, over $100 million in trying to make that happen. And we're, you know, a third of the way there or something like that. You know, it's taking a long time, a lot longer than anybody thought it would, but the efforts are continuing to get that to happen. So I think there is, you know, in my own mind, I guess, that understanding and recognition that it takes a lot of focus, especially in this community sometimes, to make these things happen. Beyond that, there is no doubt that the subarea plans in and of themselves are a statement made about focus areas, that MLK and Stadium and the rest of downtown and the Dome District are clearly intended to be focus areas for this community and where we would put infrastructure dollars and all those sorts of things for I don't know how long, you know, 5 years, 10 years, I don't know what it takes. You know, it's a question mark, and a lot of it is dependent on the market. I think in my mind, the difficulty will be, you know, we're going through this process of master plans for some of these areas, and once we get finished with those, you know, by the end of the year or whatever it is, the easy thing will be to say, oh, well, we should do more master plans, of course. Who's next, right? Everybody wants a master plan. Everybody wants a master plan, right? When the difficulty is the truth of getting redevelopment to happen is not about creating a plan, a document, a thing, whatever. It's about spending the 5 or 10 or 20 or however many years it does to actually implement that document. And the danger, so that's where I see the biggest danger. I mean, it's one thing to have a lot of centers and have a lot of areas zoned for various things to happen, but yeah, it's important to focus it some way. And I think the scary part will be, yeah, over the next 5 years, what do we do? I mean, I don't have any reason to think that somehow, you know, let's say by the end of the year we finalize the MLK subway plan, and it's not like within 6 months there's going to be 20 projects pop up and a streetcar show up and, you know, infrastructure is all going to get rebuilt. You know, the city, the 500 city bulldozers are not going out in January, you know, to sort of redevelop the entire area. So there is no doubt that area will take a while to happen. I mean, a lot of people would say they don't think it's ever going to happen. You know, I don't subscribe to that, but I think it's going to take a lot of work and take a lot of time
but
and
I
effort.
But the chair makes a very good point about the focused nature of this. Mm-hmm. And I expect, based on this slide that's up, when you go out and you talk phase two to these groups, they're going to say, okay, so looking at your map, is there any benefit for me to build in area A, B, or C? Or is there no, or we're not focusing on one, and there's no advantage to build in Proctor versus South Tacoma Way? I believe you're going to get those questions from these groups on benefits of that focus in the plan versus come on down.
Yeah.
We'd like you to build. We don't really care where you build, but they're going to be asking questions about benefits to one mixed-use center versus another, I expect.
Well, I was at a meeting yesterday, and I think it was at that meeting came up that the city's basically at its bonding capacity right now.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we're talking about mega bucks for some of these areas if you're going to go in and really redevelop them. Smaller neighborhood centers, mixed-use centers, less so. I hope somebody's pushing the button at the legislature to get back to tax income and financing so that at least you can start bonding within an area of your focus and start paying for some of these capital improvements. But it's going to be a challenge, obviously.
Yeah. So at some level, the point I make and the struggle I have internally is the idea of one way to say we should focus would be to eliminate a whole bunch of the centers, basically, and let's have two of them or four of them or I don't know what the right number is or something like that instead of 17, right? That's one approach. There's the counter to that is, well, the simple designation of the center doesn't necessarily mean that you put the full focus on every single one of them. I mean, they are, in the long term, identified as areas to transition over into a different development model, but you may have to pick within those what the focus areas are for 5, 10, whatever years, in the same way that the FOSS has been, and even as a sub-area, essentially, of downtown, like I say, has been a focus area for a long time. Not because it's called a mixed-use center or any of those things. It was just identified as an intended focus area, so we put a lot of resources and effort behind it. So,
the city could do that where it starts to incentivize with capital improvements and things. I mean, it would kind of be obvious to the development community that's, you know, if you come here, this one, they are putting in new streets, they're upgrading parks, you know, they're working with the school district and whatever. You know, the other ones don't necessarily have to go away, but they're not going to get that attention because the city doesn't have the bucks, you know, within the next 10 years to help them.
Sure. Yeah. Like I say, in my own mind, I like to think that the sub-area planning we're doing is exactly that identification of focus and hopefully the identification of where we're going to focus for a certain amount of time, those exact kind of resources and efforts that are needed. So, but it's hard, you know.
30 million square feet is a lot of space.
Like I say, it's hard not to say, well, who's next, too. So.
So is that it?
That's it.
Any other questions, comments, discussion?
I do have a question. Okay. So you're saying you're going to go out to the different communities in mm-hmm. phase two.
Yeah.
What about at least touching base with those communities during phase one? Saying, hey, this is what we're going to be doing. If you have any feedback that you want to throw out there, let us have it. And then we'll, mm-hmm. when we have it all kind of at least thought about, yeah. then we'll come back to you.
So, yeah, so phase one is actually mostly done. Those were in okay. part the findings that I went through, the kinds of things that internally staff had okay. identified as potential barriers. And our intent was really to use that as a discussion starter when we go out in phase two of kind of like, well, here's the things we're seeing. What do you guys see when you try to do, you know, these great projects?
I thought you were saying you were going to get all the answers to phase one before you even went to phase two, and that's why I'm like, I don't know if that's a good idea. No. Yeah, okay.
Are there answers to everyone?
Like I say, even going through phase one, we do phase one recognizing our own limitations of being able to question ourselves on what's right, what's wrong. It's not, like I said, not necessarily the easiest thing to do. Is say, yeah, my code's wrong for these five reasons, you know. It's a little tricky, so.
Perfect.
And this is going to kind of dovetail in, I think, with some of the work you're doing on the comp plan, land use designations, et cetera.
It certainly could, and that may, you know, there could be ties into discussions about how many mixed-use centers we have and all those sorts of things. It's hard to know exactly how that one will play out. So.
And on the surface water thing, I had made a note to myself on the last week. We talked about the open space current use assessment methodology. And Commissioner Dusick had, I thought, some excellent comments. And I was wondering if that's the kind of thing that, I don't know if it's a joint thing with the county or whatever, but as we look towards our work program for this coming next year, I would feel better if we might look at that.
At the program itself and how it's done?
Primarily how we award those. I mean, you had some legitimate concerns about, you know, stormwater detention or whatever. No, it was wetlands.
It was about wetlands. And how much credit you're getting for what kind of a wetland. You know, how good of a wetland is it?
And maybe is there really a wetland? Clarification of those standards. We've done a lot in that area over the last few years anyway, trying to define some of this. So that was just a thought I was going to share.
That
might be considered in our work program if other commissioners can.
Could be an interesting discussion with the county. Yes.
Well, we've got somebody here.
Among other things.
Let's move on to communication items and other business. I'll turn it over at this point to Mr. Wong, who will talk about commission vacancies and some of the other items.
Thank you, Chair Erickson. The Planning Commission will have three vacancies currently. Occupied by Commissioner Dusick for the environmental community position, by Commissioner Gaffney for the architecture, historic preservation, and urban design position, and by Commissioner Nush, District Number 4. If any of you wish to continue to serve on the commission, you're certainly welcome to reapply. I understand Commissioner Gaffney was just reappointed, two months ago?
He did some fancy footwork.
I just have to say sorry that you you need to reapply if you
I knew that was
considered.
Part of the deal.
That and also because that the City Council is changing the procedures. The Appointments Committee is going to sunset by the end of June, so they are going to, this month is a holiday, so they're not going to meet. But next month, the fourth Monday of June, will be their last meeting. Now, will they consider interviewing candidates for the Planning Commission? We don't know. Or will they defer that to the Infrastructure Planning and Sustainability Committee? We don't know. The other thing is that after the Appointments Committee sunsets, the appointment of individual commissions, committees, and boards will be taken on by the respective committees, standing committees of the council. So for Planning Commission's positions, it will be handled by the Infrastructure Planning and Sustainability Committee. Now, how it is going to be handled is yet to be determined. For example, is the standing committee going to interview and appoint committee members, or interview and recommend appointments to the city council for the appointments?
Right now, they recommend to the city council.
That's correct. And I checked with the city clerk's office. City clerks just recently took over from the mayor's office for receiving applications. And city clerk's office indicated to me that they don't know yet.
But to those of us applying, it's still going to be the same drill. Yeah. You apply, you're going to get interviewed by some subcommittee.
That is correct. And therefore, the decision made last week when I sent out this agenda that we're going to recruit and we're going to announce the the vacancies and have the city clerk's office start to receive application, and we'll take it from there. So the application will due a month from today, from yesterday. So you're encouraged to apply, reapply. You're also encouraged to talk to your neighbors, your affiliates, if you know of anybody who may be interested in considering. So that's the first item of communication. Second item is the North Downtown Sub-Area Plan. We talked about this earlier today. The kickoff meeting for the project will be on Wednesday, May 29th, as listed here on the agenda. You are more than welcome to attend, to participate, like you have already for the other two sub-area plans, MLK and South Downtown, which we really appreciate. The third item has to do with the 2013 annual amendment. The City Council had a study session yesterday. Brian presented your recommendations on the 2013 annual amendment to the Council. It was well done and well received. The Council had a handful of questions, but none of which required additional research from my perspective. So it went smoothly, it went well. The Council really appreciated your hard work over the past 8-9 months. Getting that out of your door. One of the things that you recommended has to do with the shoreline elements, recommending the City Council to adopt the Tacoma Waterfront Design Guidelines and the Public Access Alternatives Plan, those two documents as the implementation strategies of the Shoreline Master Program. Well, the Shoreline Master Program is under review by Ecology, so we convey that message to the Council that the Council will wait until the Master Program comes back from Ecology and then handle all three documents together. And the Council acknowledges that. And so the public hearing next week, May 21st, will not include that element in the package. So, Brian?
I was going to say the two things that I've heard that may be floating around. One, so the Master Builders Association did provide comments to the City Council. This was prior to the Infrastructure Planning and Sustainability Committee's presentation that we did, and expressing some similar concerns that they had done to the Planning Commission as well. So we are continuing to discuss that with them. I think there is one provision in the proposed regulations that we may look at a slight clarification on, having to do with the street lights, about what the requirement actually is. This wouldn't be a change, I think, in any way to what the Planning Commission is really recommending. But
the thing about pedestrian
lighting,
I think it says.
Yeah, I think when we look back at it, the language, the final language that's in there is a little more confusing than it probably needs to be, and could almost get someone to the point of requiring both standard traffic lights for cars as well as pedestrian scale lights. And I think certainly the intent all along was to say what we really wanted. If you're building a new neighborhood and you're going to have a residential street, that the idea is to have pedestrian scale lighting along the residential street. Now the reality is that pedestrian scale lighting also serves to light the street. That's where the spacing standards come from in the manuals that we refer to. So like I say, there may be a slight tweak that comes out of that in the language, but no real change in effect. The other one is, and this is from Councilmember Beau, he was very much thrilled with the idea that the code changes included the allowance for variances to most of the standards downtown where it had previously been prohibited, but he expressed a concern about whether or not the variance criteria were, in his mind, flexible enough to actually allow for the approval of
sort of good projects. Well, he was talking specifically about drive-thrus, but, you know, the idea that are the variants great, you know, if somebody comes in and wants to do something that's unique and different but is in every way a good thing, do the criteria really force you down a road of, you know, having such a unique circumstance or a historic building or all these kinds of things that, you know, maybe don't provide as much flexibility as we might want from a discretion standpoint. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he may, we'll see, he may end up proposing.
I bet he has good examples, too.
Well, we'll get into that. So he may end up proposing a slight tweak to the actual variance criteria, which would be somewhat beyond what the commission was really specifically looking at.
But as good or better than.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the concept. So the variance would allow for that sort of approval as well, so, which is hard to argue against. So.
That's right.
Thank you, Brian. And two more communication items. For the next meeting on June 5th, we're going to have Peter Huffman, our interim director, come back to talk about the department's strategic action plan to set the stage for our discussion on the division's planning division's work program, where we've talked about that a couple times today. And following Peter's presentation, Brian will probably kind of talk to you about what we have in mind. We, meaning staff and Planning Commission members, have in mind for the next 18, 24 months, what are the big ticket items we have and we want to take care of. And we'll take that information to the City Council and take it from there. So that's next meeting.
Yeah, I was just going to add on to that. You just
go ahead.
You stole most of what I was going to say there. My intent for the, you know, and I think I mentioned this at one point previously, but, you know, the commission is certainly, as based on the recommendations that were put forward this year, I mean, the intent is to really work on and collaborate with the council on the creation of the work program. So our intent is hopefully to go back to council probably in mid-June or so. This would be to committee to talk about the work program. So obviously in preparation for that, we're going to want to have a really good discussion with the commission about what sorts of things that you think are on there or should be on there. There are a number of things, and so part of the reason I say this is just as a heads up for commission members to start thinking about. At the next meeting, we want to have that kind of discussion. So if there are issues that you think are on your internal docket that you've dreamed about wanting to make sure that we move forward or at least have discussion about or decide whether they can be incorporated into the work program, please do so. We know there are some things that are floating around which we're going to be showing up on the work program. We know there's the 2015 comprehensive update, like I say, that's going to essentially span over the next couple of years probably. We have which likely incorporates the follow-up to the intensity discussion that we had this year in the annual amendment. We have this mixed-use centers project that I talked about. There is affordable housing stuff that we knew was originally in the 2013 annual amendment but was extracted out and onto its own schedule. So I think that's going to be starting up here shortly in the next month or two and is something that will show up also on that work program.
So the city is doing more of a select update. They're not opening everything up and sort of building from the bottom up on their required state mandated comp plan.
Yes. I mean, we're certainly not starting over. I will say I think we are looking at taking this as an opportunity to rethink the comprehensive plan in some senses. I think from a basic strategy perspective, the intent is not necessarily to say, how do we want to grow? I mean, the truth of the city is it's largely based on how it grew before we ever started talking about these kinds of things. So, you know, we're not going to rethink how the community is going to look in total sense. The centers are, whether we call them centers or not, the centers are going to be where they are. Mm-hmm. We're still going to have mixed-use centers. I mean, that basic growth strategy is still very much likely to be the same at the other end of this. But I think one of the things that we internally have recognized is that one of the struggles in our comprehensive plan is that it does not very clearly communicate what the vision is in a concise way. And so I think one of the things that we are really looking at is this is potentially an opportunity to rethink the structure of the comprehensive plan, how big it is, how detailed it really needs to be, those kinds of things.
So scope of work will probably come our way eventually on that.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Could I make a suggestion? We have three members who aren't here today. Is maybe send out an email to everybody and ask us to, if we have suggestions for the work program, to send them back, I guess, through Lee Wong or Brian, whoever.
Send them to Wong as well.
Okay, yeah, we'll send them through Wong.
Yeah.
And that'll speed it up. Then you can come back with a list representing all the commissioners. And we can put them up on the board, and then we can take colored dots. And
there you go. Do a little charrette. Yeah. Don't get too crazy now. We only have so many staffs.
The council's got its list, too. Don't worry.
There's 24 hours in a day.
Yeah.
Complaining about.
Only 24?
I would need 48.
Okay.
Last item I have is that the Amtrak station relocation citizen advisory committee's recommendations were presented to the Economic Development Committee of the Council yesterday by Ian Munz and our very own Chair Erickson. The presentation was well taken. A lot of kudos from the committee. So, Donnie, would you like to talk about it? It was very well done.
Well, I wished I had done a PowerPoint, because usually you go to these committee meetings and there's just, you know, the committee and maybe one or two people, you know, in the audience. And Sherry called me a couple days before, or maybe it was last Friday, and said, "Do you want a PowerPoint?" And I said, "No, we don't." So the guys before us, what were they, Chamber?
Chamber of Commerce.
Chamber of Commerce. They had a...
World Trade Center Tacoma.
Yeah. So they had a big PowerPoint, and but basically we just quickly went through the recommendations that I think we presented you with as a handout at our last meeting, and I think it went well. So at this point, if you don't have anything,
that's all I have. Thank you.
Okay, entertain a motion to adjourn.
Second.
Okay, we're adjourned.
I'm just gonna tell you, I am host.